didn't manage to make the previous session in the 90s, so I made it this time. Now, what I'm going to talk about is something that is sort of rooted in what for many people will be sort of the prehistory of the subject, because it goes back to what was something that I did in my PhD, and it's a question that I left open. And I wasn't happy that I couldn't answer it. I did occasionally think about it when I was walking to home or into the department without really having any sort of inspiration or any great feeling of enthusiasm. But then this changed about 2 years ago when we appointed a young and dynamic new member of staff, Stuart White, who some of you might have met. He was here 2 weeks ago at the previous workshop, and he's done work on masses in von Neumann algebras and 2-1 factors particularly, and he decided that we ought to start thinking about masses in C-star algebras, because there's been surprisingly little work done on those, and as a result of that I started thinking about this problem again, and remarkably it sort of has yielded to the latest assault. Now I should say this is almost my first experience using a data projector, and I've spoken to a number of people since arriving really to see what the best thing to use is, and I think these look okay. The only thing is this is actually in a DVI viewer, which is why you're seeing these bars, but I couldn't get anything that looked nicer, so here we are. So let's have a look at some history. I'm going to mention one or two other problems that are still open, because they sort of, I think, are interesting. One of the things I looked at, I hate to mention the date, really, because it's so long ago, but this was in the early 1970s. There was a very nicely written set of notes by Tommy Armour, which from some lectures he'd given in Copenhagen, on slice maps and such like, which happened to fall into my hands. I got them from Drusa McDuff, actually, who was, she just finished a PhD as I started. And she, of course, had moved on to topology, so she was inundated with all this literature, which she was no longer particularly interested in, so she passed a lot of it on to me, including these notes of Tommy Armour. Now, he looked at slice maps on von Neumann algebras, and there's a theorem he has, which is essentially a reformulation of the commutation theorem for von Neumann algebra, tensor products of von Neumann algebras, which was, as you may know, a sort of tantalizing problem for quite a time, until Demeter Takasaki theory came along. And so he'd reformulated to the slice map theorem and then proved various sort of interesting corollaries. So I started looking at similar things to C-star algebras, which indeed he had as well. So a slice map, you start off with two C-star algebras. I'm always going to write just this for the minimal tensor product. And if you have any continuous linear function on A, you define a slice map essentially from A tensor B to B like this. And so the thing I proved in my PhD, one of the things, was that if you have an abelian subalgebra of B, and you have an X in A tensor B such that for all possible phi, the image under the corresponding slice maps lies in C, then X itself has to lie in A tensor C. Now, this breaks down if C is not abelian. There are sort of readily constructed examples of C not being abelian where this breaks down, but it has various consequences. And so one of the things, actually predating this, I proved with Richard Hayden the center of the minimal tensor product is just this. So this was a counterpart of the result for Neumann tensor products, which came out of, well, in fact that didn't need the commutation theorem. And then if you take a massor Maximilian self-joint subalgebra of A, there's a bracket missing here. The relative commutant of C tensor 1, which can be defined whether B is uniform or not, is just this, what one would hope for, and this is indeed true. And so that means that then, if in fact you take masses in A and B respectively, minimal tensor product is against a masser in A tensor B. I mean, it needs a little bit of messing around when the algebras aren't unital, but basically it's all there. So the question that I asked and didn't answer then was, is the same result true if you take any other C-star completion of the of A tensor B? And I should say that Archbold and Betty extended the result for centers to any C-star completion, so they did this separately, and they used different methods, so they got that. So anyway, the question that I've just mentioned is this: if you've got two masses of C-star angles A1 and A2, and any C-star completion of A1 tensor A2, so this is the algebraic tensor product. The completion of the algebraic tensor product of C1 and C2 is, of course, always going to be the minimal tensor product because both these algebras are abelian, therefore nuclear. And so the question is this still a mass ring A tensor B? So this is really what this talk is about. But let me mention on the way, I defined a property of algebras, C-star algebras A, as follows. So this says that for any B and any C-star subalgebra D of B, whenever X has the property that its image under any right slice map is in D, then X should be in A tensor D. And I call this property S. And then something I did shortly after that was to show that there were algebras that don't have property S, and indeed that what I was basically showing, although I didn't fully appreciate it at the time, was that there exists a C-star algebra that isn't exact, namely the full C-star algebra of the free group and two generators. And it's a simple exercise to show that property S implies exactness, and nuclearity implies S. So the unanswered question is exactness equivalent to S? And so far, no idea. So it'd be nice to know. One thing I haven't written here, which I should mention, is that John Krauss has got examples where, if we go back to the previous slide, he's got examples of non-self-adjoint linear subspaces where this breaks down. So one of the main results is, in the sense of being a positive result, is that, I'll tell you in a moment, so this applies when the matter has the so-called extension property. So this, I think, was first introduced by Caddison and Singer in their celebrated 1959 paper. And so this says that, first of all, we know that any character of C is a pure state, so it has a pure state extension to A. And so if it has the extension property, that means it's got to have a unique pure state extension, and therefore a unique state extension. And in the non-unital case, you can't have a pure state of A restricting to the zero functional on C, which is a pretty reasonable condition. And now there are two equivalences. First of all, this is not completely trivial, it's basically Hahn-Banach. So one is equivalent to saying that the closed convex hull of the sort of unitary conjugates of any element X of A, that meets C in a unique point, well, in a point, and the fact that the uniqueness is not so important. And then two is equivalent to C having an approximate identity for the algebra containing it. So this, I don't really think this result merits the name theorem, and I was going to change it, but I forgot to, so this really should be called proposition. So this says that we've got two C-star algebras and a mass of C of the first one, and the second one is unital. Well then the relative commutant, this should really be, have a C, relative commutant of C tensor 1 in any C-star completion of A1, there's no one missing tensor A beta A2, is what you'd hope. So this is of course always contained in the left-hand side, but it's actually equal to the left-hand side. Now, I'm sure that given what was on the last slide, anybody who is half awake can see how this is proved. So this is how it's proved. The proof, this is in the preprint that has recently appeared on the archive, and the proof there is actually different. It's using the pure state, extension of pure states criterion that I used in the definition. But this is a fairly short proof in the unital case. So you choose any x in the relative competence and you approximate a finite linear combination, and then you can show by induction, applied to each of the ai's in turn, that you can find a unitary translate which is close to some element ci in C, and then you just put that all together and you find that there's an element of C, hence at A2, namely this, which is in some arbitrarily small distance of the element X you've started with, and that means that the element you've started with must itself be in C tends to A2. So that's what's involved there. Now, in the non-unital case, well, that is when A1 is non-unital, you simply join an identity, and then there are various little manipulations which I'm not going to go into, which are involved in getting the result. But basically, this is something that any competent mathematician, therefore a fortiori anybody in the audience, would have no difficulty with.
Where is the point that you're using something
that's a
mass?
It's a mass. I'm using the fact that it's the unitary translates. Have this property. I think that's stronger than it being a massa.
You're assuming that.
I'm assuming that. Yes. Exactly. Yes. Because I'm assuming that C has this the extension property.
Yeah.
I mean, in the unital case, you can sort of work directly with extension of states. It's a simple exercise. Anyway, so then there's a corollary. So the corollary is that if you've got two masses, one of them has the extension property, the other contains an approximate identity for A2, so we're not actually now assuming that either A1 or A2 is unital, then this has to be a massa in any Cartesian A1 tensor A2. So I proved this sometime, well, I remarked this sometime last year and didn't get very excited about it because I felt... I mean, to be honest, I felt rather ashamed that I hadn't noticed it 20 or 30 years ago. But
other examples of C1 or C2 that don't have those properties?
Yes. So, what's involved, very little really. So you take an X in the relative competent, which is now correctly written, and you take C and C1, this is the approximate identity for A2, which is contained in C2, so X commutes with any element of this form, but when you take the limit, you're basically getting X, the commutator with C tends to 1. So that's 0, so you can apply the theorem and you get this. Now, you're basically in here, and if you apply slice maps, the point is that C1 tends to A2 is... Well, C1 looks like C0 of X for some X, and so this is isomorphic to the continuous functions from X into A2, and you're basically looking at A2 value functions that commute pointwise with elements of C2, and C2 is a massa, so you end up with basically this. Now, so the question is this as good as you can get? And the answer is yes. So, in fact, this is where this is the last slide. So now what I'm going to do is to show you two examples which show that you cannot extend these hypotheses. And so in particular, masses in 2C style algebras whose tensor product is not maximum abelian in, for example, the maximal tensor product of A1 and A2.
Then you don't know which one doesn't have extension property and which one doesn't have proximal.
I do. They're the same. And then, well, first of all, the first example, they're the same. So the first is an example of A and a massa C in A, unital. Such that C tends to C is not maximal abelian in A tensor max A. Right, so this. I hope I haven't damaged anyone's hearing. Yes, people get paid for producing sound. We had somebody staying with us once who was a sound designer for movies, and he actually walked around with little microphones in his ears and a mini disc recorder to record sound effects. So, this is the first example. There are going to be two. The second one I'm going to go over more quickly than the first one because it's a variant. So, this is where our old friend, the regroup on two generators, appears yet again. So we take H, little level 2 of F2, and A is going to be the reduced least algebra of F2 plus the compact operator. So that's a least algebra. Now what's the massa? Well, the massa is pretty obvious. You take C equal to C0 plus scalar multiples of the identity. So C0, I need some more notation to define that properly. So we just take the standard orthonormal basis of F2. And EG is the projection onto the one-dimensional subspace spanned by Xi G, and then C naught is C star VG. So then, call this a proposition. C is a massa in A. C tends to C is not a massa in, well, for example, the maximal C star tensor product of A with A. Now, rather than show you in detail how you deal with the maximal tensor product, I'll just sketch how you deal with a certain other smaller completion, and which is much easier, much more transparent. and then indicate how you get to the maximal principle. So. So, first of all, T is a matter in A. I leave that as an exercise. And so the... So what I'm going to do now is to define... alpha on A times A. So we need two star representations of A times A. So this is called phi 1 and phi 2. So pi 1 is simply the identity representation on x tensor h. Now, pi 2 is contained as follows. So we have representation of C star R of F2 with itself on B of L2 of F2 defined by taking the left and right representation. So this is this is an entirely familiar representation. So G tensor A goes to lambda G rho H etc. And then if we take Q to be the quotient map from A onto A, quotient K of A, which is isomorphic to reduce C star over F2, let pi 2 be pi r composed with Q tends to Q. And then for x in A algebraic dense product A, let norm x alpha be the maximum of norm pi 1 of x. And of course pi 1 is an injective map on here, so we're going to get this already guarantees that we've got a norm. And then we take pi 2, which is this just gives us a semi norm. Two things together give us a norm, so we've got a norm. C star norm. And now this is again almost the prehistory of the subject, so the famous paper of Takasaki of 1964, he shows that the embedding of, that I've got up there, pi r, leads to a norm on that algebraic tensor product, which is not the minimal norm, so this was basically showing that there were non-nucleus fixed algebras for a start. And so we're going to exploit that fact. Now, you can actually exhibit explicit. So, this is Takasaki's result. Pi r gives a norm And what this means is that an X in the kernel, a non-zero X, which you can easily exhibit explicit examples of these X of the canonical map from the new completion to the minimal completion. And now by so it's easy to see that in this completion that I've defined there exists 0 not equal to Z in the kernel of the canonical map from A tensor A, the minimal. So now we can extend pi 1, pi 2 to representations of completion. And then note that pi 1 of x has to be, pi 1 of z has to be 0 because pi 1 factors through the minimal completion. And pi 2 of z is non-zero. So that's why z is non-zero, in fact. Now, if C1 and C2 belong to C, pi 1 of C1 into C2 is non-zero, but pi 2 is defined using the canonical homomorphism Q, which kills every compact operator. So that means that pi Q C tensor C. And C is is various compact operators plus multiples of the identity. So this is just the lambda times the identity of some lambda. So what we can say is, therefore, pi I of the commutator of Z with C1 tensor C2 has to be 0. And so Z is in the relative content of C1 and C2, but Z is clearly not in C1 tensor C2 because if it were, you see, we've got a diagram like this. So we've just got this, you see, and this is mutative. So if Z were in here, we'd have to go to something non-zero, because that's sort of perhaps of this example. It's sort of it's cute. I think that's what we describe it. Now, you can, with extra effort, show that you can replace alpha. Works for any C sum on A and A, any C sum on beta, such that beta is greater than or equal to alpha.
So that requires a bit of extra effort, but basically you look at, you take any completion with respect to beta, and then you look at irreducible representations, and so if you take any irreducible representation on A tensor A, remembering that the compacts are contained, you just think about what happens to the irreducible representation restricted to this. So if it doesn't kill this, this ideal, it's got to be basically injective, because properties of the compacts, and it's in fact got to factorize as a tensor product to representation. So it's going to be bounded with respect to the minimal norm of A tensor A. And so we get the same sort of thing here. On the other hand, if it does kill this off, then if we're in this situation, so in neither case we still get that z0. So that's how that works. And then let me very briefly say how what happens in the non-uniform case.
Is there another way of seeing that that algebra, sub-algebra fails at least stage two property?
Yes.
Yes, because I think it's fairly trivial to actually produce this examples. Well, yes, you just take a pure state on C star R two. You propose a good version. Right, that's going to be zero on the compact operators. But it's non zero on the identity, of course. You can take any number of different
equals.
No, well, that's clear. That's what he's asking, because this just shows you can't have unique. So it's just to show explicitly that it fails to have the extension property. So is it clear what
that is? Yes. So you just get any pure state of the C star R of F2. I don't know if anybody, how much anybody knows about those, gives you restricts.
Some pure state.
Well, gives you percentages.
Same pure state.
Yes. So, yeah, it's basically giving you the pure state that is the unique pure state that's zero or single. So in example two, this is with A two non-uniform. So you take an A one. Now, I should say, by the way, in the last example, I took C star R of F2 partly out of laziness, because there are all sorts of properties of it that just are there. But you can do it for a much wider class of groups. In fact, I think you could do it for all sorts of just generally simple C star algebras if you want more effort. So there's nothing particularly magic about this. So now I'm going to define... Well, the first thing to say is that if you take... the generators, canonical generators, C1, the chief algebra generated by, sub-algebra generated by U, is a matter with the extension test. This is something that's been known for a very long time, and in fact, it's the very simple proofs of this now. And I should say, by the way, if you go to the von Neumann factor, the Swan von Neumann factor, look at the Green von Neumann algebra generated by you, I think I might be saying that doesn't have the extension property. That's a real difference, which I'll return to briefly. And so, what I'm going to do is to now define a matter of C1, of A2. I'm going to define A2 and a matter in A2, which is a variant on the matter that I defined in the previous example. So I want something that's non-uniform. It's not going to have an approximate identity for the algebra, but so we use this topology. So we take two copies of A2 now. There's the normal bases E1 and F1, etc. These are the standard orthonormal bases in some enumeration, both when you define unit phase, which extends E1 to 1 over root 2, E1 plus F1, and F, EI, sorry, EI, EI plus FI, extends FI to 1 over root 2, EI minus FI. So this is a self-adjoint unit tree. So, then you take A to be U, we take C star R of F2 of the first copy, the first filter space, zero in the second. So we're basically twisting a copy, an unusual copy of C star R of F2. And then as before, we have the compact operator. So this is non-unital. And we take the C, that's little C naught. And then it turns out that then C star U tensor C is not, well, C is a matter of A, but C star of U tensor C is not a matter of C star R left 2 tensor max A. And in fact, in the same way as in the previous example, we can define a norm alpha, for which it's very easy to show that this breaks down, and then with a bit more work, we show it for any norm bigger than alpha. So this is the non-unital example. So that brings me on to the final section, which is in some ways the most tantalizing. Sorry. Anybody who needs my lawyer's address, just CC me again. Open problem. Well, these examples, I mean, they are, as I say, I don't feel any particular glory in exhibiting them now rather than 20 or 30 years ago, but I'm glad to have found them while I'm still alive. Not that but they depend crucially on the fact that the algebras, at least one of the algebras concerned, is not simple. So there's an ideal compact effect. So the question is, what happens if A1 and A2 are both simple? Is C1 tensor C2 always a matter? And I mean, there's some other questions. You can ask a very specific question. If you take a matter that's isomorphic to the continuous functions on 0, 1, does that always have the extension property? I don't have any counterexamples. It sort of seems a plausible hypothesis that it does. And so here we could say, e.g., if A1 is isomorphic to the Calkin algebra, now, the result of Junger and Pisier showed that if you look at B of H tensor B of H, the maximal norm is different from the minimal norm, so it starts to become interesting to ask what happens if you take masses of B of H. So if A1 is B of H, well, in the Caddison-Singer paper, they show that big L infinity, if you identify H with L2 of something or other, big L infinity as the, acting as multipliers is a matter. That's a much older fact. without the extension property, so the question is what happens it's not ideally put, but what happens to L infinity tensor C? C is the matter of some other algebra X. So is there, what I'm really asking is, can we find an A and a mass of C in A such that L infinity tensor C isn't a mass in B of H max tensor A? In particular, if we take A equal to B of H as well, and we take C equal to A mass in B of H. And so we could, or we could take A equal to the reduced least algebra of F2. It's known that B of H tensor C star R of F2 has maximum indifference. E.g. that A or C star of F2. So we've got max not equal to min on B of H. Again, oh, no, that wouldn't work, of course, because that's got the extension property. No, this is. Let's forget I said this. So, e.g., A equals B of H, C is a matter. I have more questions, but I think I'll make this the last one. So, supposing we take little L infinity. So what about little L infinity tensor, little L infinity in B of H tensor max, B of H, say, would equally take some other mass, another algebra here, another mass, of course, because it was more generally. So, the Kadison-Singer problem is, does L infinity have the expectation property? So, if L infinity has the expectation property, then L infinity tensor L infinity is a matter B of H tensor max B of H. So if one could show somehow, I mean, this is all one's got to do, one's just got to show this isn't a matter here. And the Kadison-Singer question has a negative answer. So, well, easy. I haven't done it yet, but
so, extension property.
Did I say expectation? Sorry, extension. Extension.
But it has the extension property that it implies a unique expectation.
It does. I've thought a bit about this, but absolutely no feel for it. So I'll end here. Yes, but then you lose the maximum breathingness.
The mass doesn't increase in the release process, they can reduce the speed for that. So it doesn't increase mass up. and it contains your algebra under the conditional expectation, so maximum test for that contains your maximum.
Well, I have to talk to you more about this in a moment, but now I tried using free products exactly to get a simple algebra, and I probably missed something since you made the statement.
I'd like to know how to physically take an example fail the hypothesis of the theorem.
Well, it doesn't have an approximate identity. The mass doesn't have an approximate identity.
Oh, the first one.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Do the masses that arise from cross products of fixed point zeros with some have interesting properties?
Well, they may. I have to admit, I mean, it has occurred to me that one should look at them, but I haven't had time to do that.
Okay,